I guess it's about time. The topic for the day, or for this hour of this afternoon, is Postgres and temporal data. My name is Chris Brown. Well, it's Christopher formally, but we shorten it to Chris normally. I'm with Afilias Canada. We are known for operating internet domain registries, and I'm a member of the Systems Architecture Group. So, keeper of database policy and development within our development organization. The agenda for today, first of all, we're going to look a little bit at what kinds of temporal data Postgres can store and what do we need when we're storing temporal data. Secondly, what kinds of data types does Postgres offer for storing temporal information? And it's mostly a very good story. Postgres has a very good set of data types. There's some limitations and some places for improvement. Then thirdly, some representations of temporality. And I've got three perspectives I'm going to look at: time travel, transaction tables, and serial numbers, that I've found use for each of these in the applications that we're building. So first of all, the question, what kind of temporal data do we need? Well, databases store facts about objects and events that are taking place relating to those objects. So there's a number of interesting kinds of points in time. So for instance, when an event took place, when it was recorded, when someone was charged for the event. So we've been doing some looking into the accounting side of things, and sometimes in accounting you have half a dozen or more dates that are associated with a single transaction. These are all potentially things that we want to capture and record. Yes?
I really hate to bother you, and I don't mean to nitpick, but every time you move your microphone, you have to show it.
Ah. Okay. How can we improve this? And let's. Is that better?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. So, moving to more interesting times. The Chinese have this curse about interesting times. But there, we have even more varieties of times that we care about. Oh, when do you start recognizing income on an event? When do you cease to recognize income on an event? When an object state begins? Oh, that's a terrible transition. And when an object state ends? Now, and these two are sort of the classic things that you'll see everywhere in all kinds of applications. The beginning and end. Postgres has a number of data types for representing time information. You've got dates, but the problem with storing things as dates is that this pre-assumes the evaluation of the cutoff between days. So if all you're recording is July 17th, well, you have to pre-evaluate whether the cutoff is 11 o'clock or 12 o'clock a.m., p.m., Eastern Standard, Central Standard, whatever time zone that you're picking. You have to pre-evaluate the cutoff, and if you ever have a need to change that timing, you're out of luck. You got to go back and do something terrible to recompute things. Time with or without time zone. You can take a date and a time as two fields, but they have the problem that comparisons of date and time turn into hideous SQL. So if the date matches but the time doesn't match, then this one's bigger than that one. Otherwise, if the dates are different, then everything's clear, but if the date's the same, then maybe they're the same or not, or yo. Evil SQL code. So generally speaking, timestamp, which combines date and time, is a much more convenient piece of information. This in one atomic type combines most of what you need. But actually we can go a further step to timestamp with time zone, which records what time zone you were in when you were recording this and recognizing that. So you can tell what time it was in a consistent fashion across time zones, and even say, oh, well, by the way, I recorded this in GMT, or I recorded this in Pacific time, or whichever ones Postgres recognizes. Another data type that's very useful is interval, and this is the difference between two times or timestamps, and is a wonderful thing for indicating duration of time ranges. And up to this point, well, the SQL standard doesn't have timestamp with time zone. It has timestamp without time zone. And it does have intervals. So you can sort of expect these kinds of data types to be available in all kinds of databases, which is a nice thing. Then there's operators. Well, you take a time or a timestamp or a date, add an interval to it, and you get another time, timestamp, or date. You take two timestamps, subtract one from the other, you get an interval. And it's similar for the others. Timestamp, time, date, we'll all try to do this. If you subtract a date from a date, you're not going to get hours. You'll pretty much just get days. But within those limitations, these all work. You can compare timestamps and dates and times. There's the relational operator A between B and C, which is useful, but here's one of the edge cases when looking at temporality. This A is inclusively between B and C. And that's useful for a lot of cases, but not, I'll hit this again. I want to like between a lot. I find I like it less and use it less than I wish I could.
The
inclusion or exclusion of the endpoint is really the key there. I'm not sure what the other databases do for this. It would be more useful for it to exclude the endpoint. So A is between B, but is below C. And it's if you're doing date ranges, you're saying, if you're doing date processing, what are all the transactions today? The nice way of representing that is from the beginning of today, the first second of today, and less than the first second of tomorrow. So yeah, you're right on it. Then we have various variations on when is it now. Now the function now is also equivalent to transaction timestamp, is also mapped to current timestamp. These are all indicating what time did this transaction begin. And actually, as we've been working on various applications in redesign at Afilias, our conclusion has usually been that we almost always want now. Now is consistent, and now is usually good enough. You can also capture the statement timestamp. When did this statement begin to execute? You can capture clock timestamp, which is what is the second, millisecond, maybe even microsecond right now. So that will progress as you work on the transaction. Finally, a neat thing to have would be a transaction commit timestamp. Well, it's the begin point is now, the endpoint is the commit timestamp. Alas, we don't have the commit timestamp available to us. However, there has been, come on, click. Jan Wieck has done some work on this, and it hasn't reached the point of being releasable. A strategy for doing commit timestamps would be to record the new data type would be a commit timestamp, and it doesn't store a timestamp. It stores a server ID and the CTID, the transaction ID. And at commit time, if any transaction has used such a timestamp, we have a variable in the back end that records whether anything has added such a timestamp. And if that's happened, then we insert the server ID, CTID, and the clock timestamp, well, indicating what moment is it, into a timestamp table. And in principle, this could eliminate the Sloney sync thread, and I think Lone Deist has a ticker. The way that some of the replication systems work, and this is actually where this commit timestamp came from, the way that they tend to work is they have to look for what's been committed, or what has been committed since the last set of data that we processed. And if we have a timestamp that actually shows us that value, then we can just use that instead of having to do a sort of a reconciliation of which transactions were outstanding and which ones no longer are. It would simplify Sloney, some of the nasty bits of Sloney, and probably Lone Deist, and it would be useful for doing multi-master replication and other cool stuff. So, helpful for multi-master replication strategies. Hooray! Unfortunately, it adds a table full of timestamps that needs cleansing. And so this is why there was pushback against it. There is a nifty PG Foundry project called PG Temporal, and this implements a data type called period, and a period is two timestamps, from this time to that time. And it implements all of the logical operations that you would put in along with this. And a first thing to mention, and that this comes back to your comment, it supports inclusive and exclusive periods within the values. So people who remember their calculus may remember open and closed ranges, where the closed brace indicates that you're including the edge as part of the range. The round parenthesis indicates that you're going up to but not including the edge. Beginning and ending, ending and beginning, hooray. And commonly, the from, where we start at the very beginning but avoid the very last instant, tends to be the ideal representation. So like today, it's easy to characterize today's data as the data from the beginning of May 22nd to all but the last instant. All but the first instant of tomorrow. That you don't have to say, you're not left hanging on, okay, did I round the seconds the wrong way? Did I miss the last millisecond? Oh, what if we make things, if we increase the number of decimals in the representation, did I lose the last microsecond? And in many cases, it's not a problem, but like we run systems that are up 24/7, and many users in at any given time, there can be transactions in the first second of the following day. There can be multiple transactions in that second. We've had times when that second, that happens to be a very busy time of the system. And similarly, this month's period would be from the beginning of May to the to just before the beginning of June. And successive period, and part of the point is successive periods don't overlap. These two values are represented twice, but they don't actually overlap. And SQL between is equivalent to from and to in square braces. Now, the PG temporal system has a veritable panoply of operators. Length of a period, what is the first moment in a period, what is the last moment in a period, what is the moment, what is the instant immediately before the beginning of this period, what is the first instant inside the next period. You've got essentially set operators indicating containership, adjacency, overlaps of various kinds, is it empty, is one before the other or after the other, and so forth. And then functions to create periods. You take a timestamp, and you can create the period that is from that timestamp to that timestamp. That's a very short period of time, but still meaningful. Or a somewhat longer period of time. And it's got all of the kinds of error checking that you would expect, that you can't create a period that doesn't internally make sense. The end time has to be after the from time, for instance. If you try to combine, click. Come on. Panoply of operators. There we go. Intersect, union, and minus. And the ones that should error out with exceptions, if you try to take an intersection of, if there's an intersection and they don't actually overlap, that's a problem. If you try to subtract something from if P2 is inside P1, then you'd be left with two periods, which doesn't make sense. So that would raise an exception. An open question is, should this be in core? I think this set of operations and operators and functions, and this I keep being tempted to implement a period date type. I find it I haven't been prepared to add PG temporal into any of our important systems, because adding in things that aren't in the core is like moving heaven and earth in an operational environment. Like, it's hard enough for us to deploy Sloney, and we've got a special DNS type that we sometimes use. Adding in additional things that aren't in the core is troublesome. I would really like to see this in core, and I'm curious as to what we would need to do to get PG temporal into core. So this, I don't think there's any of the necessarily too many relevant people. Well, actually, there are core people here. So, mumble.
They're not listening.
They're not listening. Oh well. Okay.
Is that period type defined in any of the SQL
standards? No, that's in effect the problem. It's not defined in any of the standards. The PG temporal project has built the logical set of values and functions and operators to make it convenient to use it. It's logical. It's probably too logical for the SQL standard to accept it in that form.
Well, follow up then, does an NGINX
interval algebra. It can be used for temporal and spatial data. It's an alien interval algebra.
Interval algebra?
Certain operations is required.
Okay, I'm not.
It's sort of standard.
Okay.
And what's about indices?
Indices are a bit of a problem because one, I'll hit that in a couple minutes. So if I can put that off, I'll get back to that. I'm going to jump now into sort of the next phase of this, looking at temporal representations. Now, the classical way that of representing temporal information is described in the book Developing Time-Oriented Databases Applications in SQL. This is a really good book, about 400 pages longish. It used to be published by Morgan Kaufman. It's out of print. The author has made it available freely as a PDF. It doesn't have a discussion of Postgres-specific issues, but it presents its implementations for all of the major commercial databases, including some that people don't tend to use anymore. So it's got sample implementations in Oracle, DB2, Informix, Sybase, SQL Server. Don't think it tries MySQL. It doesn't expressly do Postgres. There's one or two others that it does that are less known names. It uses periods, much as we have in PG Temporal, but since the SQL standard hasn't defined a period type, it basically uses from and to dates. The book pays considerable attention to how you handle the insertion of both past and future history. One of the grand challenges that comes in when you're working with temporal information, and for any of these, the issue comes up in much the same way. Foreign keys are a problem. So for non-temporal tables, there's no temporality, there's no problem. If you're referencing from a temporal table to a non-temporal table, so you've got something over here that's temporal, what's the state of the object, and it's pointing to configuration information that's non-temporal, again, no problem. Referencing non-temporal information isn't very hard. But if the reference table is temporal, this is really quite troublesome. Referential integrity may be violated simply via the passage of time. If you've indicated that this is something is true from now until 10 minutes from now, suddenly that state is no longer the case 10 minutes from now, and when we reach that point in time, we may have lost some essential linkage. And then it gets a little bit worse. Referenced and referencing tables may vary independently. So if both of them are temporal, then it's actually hard to think about what's going on. As wishful thinking, and purely wishful, I'm not even thinking about how to try to do this. It would be nice to have foreign keys in a temporally sensitive fashion. I don't believe it's actually worth trying to implement this because there's so many different meaningful ways of doing temporality, and whether or not the semantics are, whether or not it's acceptable to lose the reference is open to the viewer. The next problem is that of comparison. This goes back to indexes. Yes, what does it mean for from this period to this, from T1 to T1, what does it mean for it to be bigger than that second value? We actually have, if we step back to those functions and operators that PG Temporal offered, well, it's, maybe they overlap. Maybe the one of them begins before the other. Maybe one of them ends after the other. These are all possible indications of greater than or less than. You don't have a unique way that an index would be represented. So to that question, there isn't a single answer. If you're trying to index these sorts of things, you effectively need, well, with PG Temporal, you would do a functional index, or maybe more than one. If you're dealing with this by hand, by just having a to and a from field, you may have multiple indexes again. It's really inherently ambiguous. Maybe GIST has something to say here. I'm not sure. There, you might get something that helps a bit. Although, maybe the right answer is to just say, I'm comparing based on the from date, or I'm comparing based on the to date. Postgres time traveling, Eileen Mustaine has presented on this on a number of occasions. It's a little bit of a hack. We take a stateful table, we add triggers to automatically capture from and to timestamps. When you do an in search, it's true from now until the end of time. You do an update, it says the old row terminated now, and inserts a new row from now until the end of time. Delete says, well, terminate now. Unfortunately, this breaks if you need to have referential integrity constraints that point to the table. So foreign keys are a problem. So I think I've already mentioned what the actions are. So pulling specific state, well, the current state, they establish a view where the current state is all of the tuples where the end time is null. Infinity would be another good representation of this, but she uses null. The state at a particular time runs a set returning function. So select star from table at time, and the value that you pass in is the timestamp that you want to query as of. It pulls all the tuples that are effective at that time. So anything where the start time is less than or equal to that time, anything where the end time is null, or where the end time is after that time. What we've been finding useful in our applications is to accept that we're in a temporal system to begin with. We don't try and magically introduce this information. We're not just getting history for free. This gives us actually a nice further step. It enables us to do science fiction. We can declare future state. 9 a.m. next Wednesday, the state of that object will change. It's pretty cool. It allows us to eliminate all kinds of batch jobs. We set up right now that things will happen at the right times, and the system doesn't need to do anything. We may need to pre-record some future dated events, but it's pretty cool. We can go time travel. We're traveling into the future and sometimes back into the past. It does have some problems. Foreign keys. Foreign key references into here are problematic. What if they overlap? You have the timings overlap, or what if the reference disappears? Fixing problems becomes more troublesome because you're not just fixing the state, you have to tell the story of that past history that got broken. So the state of the system definitely becomes inherently more complex. Another representation is to not use from and to, but rather to use transaction timestamps. So we have a transactions table. I've been using this quite heavily for configuration-ish tables. So we have a transaction ID, which collects a value from a sequence. We collect who done it, who's responsible, and we could track more information than this. Who done it and when. And then we have this slightly temporal object, which is, okay, we're doing something with this object, and when we do something to it, part of the default behavior is it pulls a transaction ID from the connection and says, okay, transaction 15, well, we updated this on transaction 15. If we go a little bit more temporal, we put in an onUpdate trigger that anytime you update the table, well, we update that transaction ID to the current value. We could go even more into the past, back to the future, and create a past history table. It has a similar schema to the original table, but we have to drop all data validation because there are no foreign keys. The foreign keys, we're deleting data from this table. And we could be doing this to many tables. This is a historical record, not an ongoing concern that validates itself. We add an end transaction so that when data gets inserted into this history table, we know when that data became effective and we know when it ceased to be effective. And we can trace back to however much information that we had in that original transaction table. So this provides us some more information than we had, more than just temporality. We can say who did it, and maybe what session they were attached to and whatever other information that we might have tied to that. Update and delete, throw any obsolete tuples into this past history table. And data validation has to get dropped because validation can change over time. So, and you want to even take off things like constraints on columns. So if it was a varchar 4 characters long, the history table, I would only want to be text. Because over time we might change this we might change the validation on the table. I presented this to our DBAs, and I had a sample implementation that would even survive Sloney replication. If you ran the trigger generator function, it would alter the history tables on the fly. They thought that was a little bit too scary to use, but depending on your application, this might be acceptable. And the third form of temporality that we've been finding really useful is that of serial numbers. And this is a notion used in DNS, where over time, well, it's a serial, always incrementing, never moving backwards, and sets of updates get propagated through the DNS system attached to serial numbers. So it's basically grouping sets of updates, adds and drops. The bump of the serial number indicates that everything's getting published at some common point in time. So the previous representation was each logical transaction in your system, things would be tied to the logical transaction. In this case, the logical transaction is we decided to publish all this stuff together. So here's how a zone sort of looks. This is similar to a zone. So if we consider that we have an object, we have name servers. In DNS, you have name servers and they'll have IP addresses attached to them. And let us suppose we've got two zones we're managing, one for org, which Afilias happens to manage, and one for info, which Afilias happens to manage. This first tuple indicates that for this name server, the IP address was this, from serial number 1 to serial number 3. And at that point, for whatever reason, it got dropped out. I don't have another entry that says ns1.abc.org for that. So I have one down here, but it's in a different zone, so it doesn't count. Then in this case, we're marking that the The second row is indicating that we changed the IP address in serial number 3. So from serial number 1, in serials 1 and 2, the value is that. After that, it's that. And we've got similar things for these other name servers. Name server 2 was introduced in serial number 2 and is true until the end of time, at least as far as we know what the end of time is. And a separate series of serial numbers for a different zone. So the idea here is we can store all of the information in a common table and easily determine what the values are at different points in time. It's got a number of merits. It's fast. We can extract multi-million record zones in minutes, and considerable portions of that time are the time pushing it across the network. I'm not at all sure that the database is the bottleneck. It may be seconds, but it can read it as fast as it can pull it off disk. You've got an arbitrary ability to roll back, so you can step back to as many serial numbers, actually as whenever you, as far back as you go, you can go. From a DNS perspective, and this is not so much an issue for the viewers of this talk, well, it really nicely supports, in DNS, there's two major operations. An AXFR is where you transfer all of a zone. You say, there's a million entries in that zone, I want all 1 million. IXFR is an incremental transfer, which says, yeah, I'm on serial number 45. Oh, you've got serial number 47. Tell me the difference. This representation makes it very efficient to do both of these things. Each serial number represents a sort of a logical commit. If we rename zone to module, this is quite nice for configuration, and we're adopting this as part of our systems configuration strategy. We already knew it supported lots of data efficiently, so we know we can do that. We hope our configuration will be smaller than million record zones, and it allows us to trace back to arbitrarily to any point in time for our configuration. It does have some demerits. There's no way to specify a point of time in the future. The serial numbers are intended to just keep chugging along. They increase, they never decrease. However, as with complicated applications and configuration, fancier forms of temporality look like they're more of a misfeature than a feature. If we try and, we've got plenty enough configuration that if we try and precisely schedule, oh, this should come into effect tomorrow at 3, that should come into effect the day after that at 7 p.m., that starts getting unmanageable sort of conceptually. People start having a hard time even thinking about how the configuration system will behave, and things start happening by magic. So this is a little bit more primitive, but we hope more usable. So, wow, this is, I'm coming to my conclusions. Well, I've presented 3 ways of representing temporal information. Via timestamps, transaction IDs, and serial numbers. There are some changes that might be meaningful to make in Postgres to try and make this sort of stuff better. And my open question is, should PG temporal be added to core, or should we? That may be too specific. I was in the how to try and get a patch through talk this morning, and the answer isn't, oh, should we just add this, but what more should we have in core? I think having something like that would be meaningful and useful. I did a census of our configuration and discovered that every single case where we have dates, it was fair to represent them as being pairs of dates. We have no cases where we use dates where period would not be the right answer. Well, except for the simple case of this event took place at this point in time. But for anything that's indicating configuration style information, I would challenge people to think about any cases they may have. I would challenge you to show a case where it's not indicating a period of time. If it's open-ended, it may be from the beginning of time until some point in time. It may be from now until the end of time. So infinity being, if we consider infinity as being legitimate values, I challenge people to come up with anything where that doesn't fit. Much more wishful. I don't think this is a serious consideration. I don't think we should try to have temporal foreign key functionality in core, because the variations there seem just too big. You might want to create a trigger that a trigger and a function going along with that enforces certain temporal policies. For that to be something that we try and have as a policy that core would, the core database would support, you create a period type and have a reference to it, and you automatically get this set of rules. But maybe we should. I'm open for questions.
I've got a few things here. In the courts, we do have some of the same kinds of things that you're talking about in terms of effective date ranges. And in particular, let's take the case of criminal law. So, you know, there's a particular law in the books with particular penalties. It has an effective date. Initially, the expiration date's open-ended.
Yes.
They change the law. They replace it with a different law. You have to expire that first law, have an effective date for the new penalty or the new statute. And that's extremely important later, because you can't pass a law that makes what you did yesterday illegal now or makes the penalty higher. So you're always matching a charge, offense date, against these temporal ranges, so that you are charging them under the right law with the right penalties available. So
yeah.
this kind of structure makes a lot of sense in other environments than what you're dealing with. just that as a first comment. Idea of transaction IDs as a temporal thing kind of bothers me just because of wraparound issues and what happens when you upgrade the PG dump and load.
And in this case, the transaction IDs, I wasn't proposing using the internal transaction IDs. No, the notion here is we have a transactions table which is populating a sequence value.
Okay.
It's using a sequence value to populate that transaction ID. So no, this
it's
isn't using any
getting a sequence number. Essentially, you're not talking about Postgres transaction IDs.
That's right.
I feel better.
Okay. Yeah, I think the original form of time travel, back before they called it back before they put SQL in Postgres, actually did something like that, where you were tracking essentially by transaction ID. But this is an explicit representation, not trying to take the information implicitly.
Opinion personally on the subject of the expiration being null versus infinity. Null makes more sense to me because it means unknown or doesn't apply, and that seems a very good fit for what you're dealing with in that case. So I think null's the right choice. It makes the range test.
I like
harder,
both,
but conceptually it's more sensible.
If we go back to the period. With the period type that's described by PG temporal, it wouldn't be meaningful to have a null end time. You need to have an actual time of some sort, and infinity seems perfectly good to me in the sense that it's indicating it isn't indefinite in the future, and I realize it's. We probably don't think that law is probably not going to be good in 2299, but...
Certainly not the penalties. Are very young. They change those by the week, practically.
I tend to fall into the nulls. Nulls are usually an evil thing. They definitely add...
The argument has been had over and over. Argument in favor of not using a magic value for unknown has prevailed generally.
Yeah. Okay.
So
fire away.
Let's talk about triggers. Triggers are event driven, right?
Yes.
So right now we've got basically three types of triggers. You know, insert event, update event, or delete event. What I would like to see, and you can shoot this down, or anybody can shoot this down, I would like to hear an argument against it, is create a new type of event which is passing of a certain time. So I could set time on a row, and when the time passes, that'll fire my trigger and I can do something.
Okay, this is actually one of the challenge areas. If you're using a time temporal representation, so from and to, and you're creating science fiction, you're saying I'm fabricating the state of things as of 6 days from now. You may need to have something take place 6 days from now. The strategy that I've been taking when I get into that situation is to, I effectively fire the trigger right now. I fire the trigger immediately, record the information in some form of event table, and indicating that this needs to be run 6 days from now. We then need the magic of something needs to be watching it to be prepared to do something 6 days from now.
Right, you're still in a batch process there.
Yeah. That's potentially either a downside or an upside. You can take it both ways. If you're scheduling something off in the future, and you need something to happen in the future, you need to have some way to trigger something to happen in the future. You don't have a way to make anything execute 6 days from now. you need to have some component that's running that's going to be able to say, okay, I have work to do.
I think the futuristic tool for that, like 23rd century, is CRON.
Ah, PG Cron?
Still Cron.
Yeah, it's, we're trying to avoid Cron, but yeah, that's the strategy that we've taken in conjunction with that. So
I think it would be interesting to have that kind of expressed in the language itself, you know, as opposed to an external sort of process.
Okay. Interesting. Interesting. I will see Seneca on Monday. I will tell her about that.
And then for actually triggering things at certain times, I get worried about that. Like if the server clock changes for whatever reason, if you get something that runs twice or that doesn't run when it should have, that sort of messes things up.
That's a good point. That's a risk that enters. So
of your server, you might that, get
we
the
call
event.
That the Groundhog Day.
The Groundhog Day effect. As long as we can get Jim, if we can get Jim Belushi involved.
Savings time switches when it starts.
Mm-hmm.
The meeting moves to a different moment in time.
So I mean, even well, how do you handle something like that?
All of our publicly facing systems are operating the extensible provisioning protocol, which is an IETF defined protocol, which defines itself to operate in UTC. So we operate all of our server, all of our environments, all of our production environments operate in UTC, and there is no changing of time zones. We've had governments have asked us, oh, we would like you to operate our registry in our time zone, and we've had success at rebuffing such attempts and saying, no, the public standards say UTC. So that's been our answer.
Yeah, that makes sense for you.
That's not an answer that's useful for you, but that's been what's been successful for us. I'm not sure what the good answer to that is. There is a good thing about timestamp. The good thing about timestamp with time zone is it does record unambiguously a timestamp that's expressed in UTC terms, and it also records what time zone you recorded it in. So you can extract this sort of information after the fact.
That's not true. That's what the SQL standard says it should do. That's not what Postgres does. Postgres changes it to UTC, or GMT actually, I believe, and doesn't store the time zone that was expressed in initially. So you do lose that information. That's why some of the standard SQL date map completely falls apart in Postgres, because we're not storing the data in the format they require.
Okay, I have to.
the way we solved that was just to record future appointments like that, which will be sensitive to time, daylight saving time, as a date and a time without time zone. We stay away from the timestamp for those, because a timestamp, and we use timestamp with time zone to record moments in time that something happened. But for future appointments that are going to depend on daylight saving time, we don't.
That seems like a reasonable solution to that, and it's for those that are maybe watching in the future. He suggested for the cases where you require both, where you're expressing future times, you could express the date. You store a date stamp and a time without time zone. This means that you'll have to reconstruct it at the time that you process it. But that means that you've got the original information in its original form. And apparently Postgres loses the original time zone. I'm not aware of that, so that's news to me. I've been successful at avoiding that issue via our preference for UTC. And there's a fair, if you operate across any kind, if there's any jurisdictional boundaries that you cross, this is actually a pretty usable strategy. If you're only inside one state of Wisconsin, you're only within Wisconsin, this is not an argument that you can very easily make. So you can't say, we'll be objective, we'll use a common standard.
When somebody gets a citation from the officer that says, show up in court on this date at this time, they're going to go by what the clocks say all around them, not by UTC.
Well, hopefully they don't have any of the jurisdictions around there where there's like weird, there are some places where they have some really weird handlings of recognition or non-recognition of daylight savings time.
But, and even that changes, actually.
And
somebody else mentioned this, but a lot of these interval operators have applicability in geometry as well, in computational geometry.
Okay. Okay. The comment is that it would be nice for these operations to not just apply to timestamps or periods of time, but also to look at geometric objects. And yes, and there's the same principle that greater than and less than don't work the same way. Like this circle greater than this square? Maybe the volume is larger. The volume of this cube is larger than the volume of this sphere. The XY location of parts of this geometric object are further over on one axis than another. You have the same property of it being ambiguous, and you essentially have to do a projection onto a line in order to assert that something is one thing is greater than another. We've got about one more minute, so if there are any other quick questions.
I'll throw one out there. That Snodgrass guy wrote another book on T-SQL 2 language.
Yeah.
I didn't hear you mention that. Is that still valid, or is it just
I'm afraid I haven't looked at it. I've read through the one book, and offered to send him money. He didn't say yes. I was just sort of disappointed. I sort of looked at it and said, this book is valuable to me. We're printing off several copies for office use. I'd be happy to send you $40. But I can't speak to the other book, but definitely Snodgrass has been one of the authoritative sources of work on temporal database work, particularly relating to SQL. Thank you all.